colonial Chinese history, but my impression of it is that it's always been very patriarchal.
Mm. Confucius, right? He was very...
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's right.
The male is the master of the family.
Male is the master of the family. And if we all pledge loyalty to the emperor, we will have a happy society.
Mm.
But I do know that in modern China, there's a huge gender gap because with the one-child per family policy, everyone wanted boys, and now the Chinese are quickly realizing, oh, wait, we have all these bachelors.
Mm-hmm.
And when I've been single, I am, like, maybe toying with, like, and maybe dealing with feelings, like, really wanting to be in a relationship, feeling a little desperate. Like, I've always thought about asking my parents about...
setting you up.
Yeah, setting me up.
Yeah.
But then I think about...
Like plan B, right?
Yeah, kind of like a plan B. It's like, I would like to try out an arranged marriage with a single Chinese bachelor and who makes a lot of money or whatever. But then, like, I think, if he's Chinese, he's going to be baked in so much patriarchy and male privilege. And, do I really want to deal with that? My answer is always, no, I don't want to deal with that.
That's fair.
But I have also heard that Chinese families, they will pay huge dowries to overseas Chinese women and sort of like repatriating like Chinese ancestry-born women to come marry their, like,
oh, wow,
their bachelor sons.
Mm.
But, yeah.
You're like, it'd have to be a lot of money.
It had to be a lot of chihuahuas. Yeah. Definitely a lot of chihuahuas.
Are there chihuahua farms in China? I don't know.
I will start one.
Yeah.
If there is a bachelor that can pay me in a million chihuahuas, I will go back to China and just be surrounded by tiny dogs. It makes me sound so shallow.
Therapy chihuahuas, service dogs, you know.
There's a need
that
for
can
that
help you deal with all the patriarchy.
This is true. With enough chihuahuas, I can fill the void left in my soul.
Oh.
Oh gosh, sounds so sad. But what are your other thoughts about trash Asian men?
Oh man, don't get me started.
She's
now.
Like, so many,
so many.
Yeah, I think it's mostly the hyper masculinity mm-hmm. aspect of it, and just how much it annoys me that Asian men just feel so wronged.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can imagine, you know, the stereotypes that are cast on Asian men are. Mm-hmm. They don't feel good for sure, and and especially dating wise, it's not fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Asian men have to realize that fetishization, being desirable in that way, mm-hmm. is awful.
Mm-hmm.
Really awful. It's so dehumanizing, and you can get yourself into a lot of terrible situations.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm speaking from experience here in that. If you're not careful, I mean, mm-hmm. there's so many men out there mm-hmm. who are just wanting you mm-hmm. because of those reasons.
Yeah, yeah, just because you're an Asian woman. And I know, like, in my dating history, like, I've definitely, like, I was always aware of the Asian trope, of the Asian submissive woman fetishization. And I will also admit, before Tabby got woke, I would sometimes play into that a little bit. And if I dated a dude that did have an Asian fetish, like, I somehow felt a little flattered. And now, like, I look back on those halcyon definitely naive days. It's like, ugh, we could have been better, Tabby. We could have been so much better.
I mean, it's hard, right? Because... in a certain respect, you mm-hmm. know, it's like, oh, yay, I'm getting attention from this. But once you get in, you realize how
kind of toxic
it feels.
What kind of bad attention that is.
I feel like all of that just kind of mm-hmm. goes away because you realize, like, this mm-hmm. is not... I'm not being treated like a person.
Yeah, right? Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I definitely realized, oh, wait, I am a person and I need to seek out and be in relationships with people that value me as a person and not because of my race or ethnicity. And
it's hard.
It is hard.
Sometimes there are those hidden fetishizers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I kind of got to a point where if I was like interested in a white guy or something, right? Mm-hmm. I would scroll through all of his social media profiles to see, you know, if there are any clues or hint or evidence or something like that of
him. Do you hang out with a lot of Asian people, particularly Asian women?
Yeah, it's like how many photos does he have where he has his arm around like an Asian girl?
It's like that scene from Get Out when
oh, you mean with the photos?
Yeah. With all the black men, it's like, oh boy.
Yeah.
What if I found myself in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like can be unsafe, right?
It for mm-hmm. sure can, and you never really know. Sometimes they
hide it really
they
well.
They hide it really well, and then it's only after spending a certain amount of time with them when you realize you're like, wait a second, this is not...
Yeah. You only like me for how I look, not like my opinions or my thoughts or my hobbies. Yeah. So gross.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be quite a long process of unpacking that and also trying to... I guess it's sort of trying to find yourself among all of those stereotypes, because some of them for me particularly might be true, but maybe I'm also trying to rebel against it and not being my true self. So it's trying to figure out what is really me and what are just things that have been projected onto me.
I definitely, even though I know you can't see me or Sarah, but we're both wearing dresses and I'm wearing a very feminine dress, which is not something I usually wear. But after this, I'm hanging out with some friends, and I just I felt like having a cute day. Today's my cute day. But I also, like, totally know that, oh, God, like, people that just see me out on the street, like, they're going to have certain preconceived notions about me and how I behave and what I'm gonna... It's like, they're gonna think I'm gonna be all giggly, then I'm gonna be all cute, and then I'm gonna be all demure. It's like...
But then at a certain point, it's like, people are gonna think what they're gonna think anyways, that's and true. Just based on your Asian face, they'll probably think things already, so who cares?
That's right. I have unicorns and Pegasi. Okay. On my dress.
Whatever you want.
Yeah, it's pink and it's teal. I'm feeling good.
It's very charming.
Good about myself.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard, right, to figure out who you are outside of or, you know, within those certain confines because,
how to break stereotypes and how... Like, what stereotypes do I fall into?
For me, also sort of bringing it back to gender, when I first came out as genderqueer in March 2018, I think it was, I feel like I had a period after that of very much leaning into masculinity. And I feel like since then, kind of over time, I've sort of moved back a little bit the other way, especially in terms of how I dress and present to... And I'm not sure that any of it is static, right? Like, it could change. It could change at a moment's notice. But it's been hard for me trying to figure out where I am
now,
on that.
Like, changing your dress into a suit now.
Yeah. I had an envy friend who was like, don't call me cute, say I'm handsome. And I'm like, okay, I can get behind that.
Yeah, but I feel like for me, it's like, it's been shifting a lot. And I think that's because at the beginning it was... so much of a rebellion against what people expected me to be, which was very feminine. You know, I cut my hair. My hair is still short because I just like it this way. But I feel like my style of dress has sort of moved back towards being a lot more femme.
What you're wearing right now, I think, is the most feminine thing that I've seen you wear.
Yeah, I also haven't worn this dress since I was, like, 17 or something. It's laundry day, you guys.
I mean, I think you look great no matter what you wear.
Thank you, Tabitha. Yeah.
I mean, and I've been thinking, in the past few years, I've also been playing around with my wardrobe. I definitely identify as cis, but male, I definitely find an appeal, more of an appeal for male clothes and fashion.
I mean, anybody can wear whatever. That's the thing, right? Clothing shouldn't be gendered in the first place.
Exactly. And I particularly want to save up money for, I interviewed with this local clothing company called Duchess Clothier. They make custom suits. They make custom suits particularly for men and for both men and women. And they, like, don't care what gender you identify. They will make you a suit, mm-hmm. and they will make a pant. They also make pantsuits as well as dress suits.
Wait, what is this place?
Duchess Clothier. They are really close to Division and 12.
Oh, I've been in their store before.
Yeah. And I didn't get the job that I interviewed for, but it did make me aware of them. And of course, during the interview, they talked me through their process, and it was really fascinating, and it really inspired me to, like, man, I want to save up and get a custom suit from them. Mm. And they, like, custom everything. They don't make the suits in the shop, but you can pick your own fabric, the lining, mm-hmm. the buttons, all the little details, and yeah, I, like, really want to get a custom pantsuit.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. And like, and not two pieces. No, there's no jacket and pants. There will be a jacket, a pants, and a waistcoat with my suit. It'll be a three-piece suit.
Oh, dang. Man.
I'm imagining it now.
You have planned this out. That's awesome.
I will be such a dapper gentleman.
When the image in my head is very dapper.
Yes, that's what I want.
Just a little reminder that you are listening to Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio, where producers Jake, Sarah, and Tabitha are having a casual roundtable.
Do either of you have anything you want to share? It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be about Asian men or anything.
Well, what you mentioned about the whole Proud Boys thing that was at the end of June. Mm-hmm. I was not here in Portland because I was in Washington, D.C.
That's right. Yay. Tabby went to D.C.
Yeah. And it was a lot of fun. I had been to D.C. before, but I was like single digit age child. So it's been 20 some years, very long time. And I have a friend that lived there, and with my new job, I'm able to afford to travel more, and it's been a while since I saw my friend, so I was like, let's go hang out. He doesn't live in D.C. He lives in Arlington, which is just across the Potomac from Washington, D.C., and I spent 6 days there, and of course, I saw all the big things. I saw the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial. The Lincoln Memorial looks really nice at night, just letting y'all know. And saw the Vietnam Memorial and the Korean War Memorial, and walked through the World War II Memorial that opened in 2004. I only remember that because there was a plaque that said it was commemorated by George H.W. Bush in 2004. Mm. And I also think, like, the contrast between these three memorials is really interesting, because I definitely feel, like, there's definitely a very somber feeling between the Vietnam and the Korean War Memorial, and the World War II Memorial feels very celebratory and, like, victorious. And for me, I feel like that's reflective of how these wars have turned out. Because, like, in World War II, there was a very definite bad guy that we were all trying to fight. And the Vietnam War and the Korean War, they were pretty pointless wars. They were wars about politics and devastated two countries that, when they were switching to communist governments, I believe it was, like, by the consent of the people. Like, the people wanted these communist governments. Of course, not everyone wanted them, and so of course the U.S. moved in to support the anti-communist fighters. And in some cases, it's like the non-communist combatants weren't always any better than the communists. And I don't know, so I definitely feel like the Vietnam and Korean were, they were very like somber and reflective, and the Korean War Memorial I felt was a bit was very unsettling because it depicts 19 statues and they're soldiers, and I think they're meant to be walking through underbrush, but these statues are also like pretty human size and they're very lifelike, so it's a little unsettling because they're so lifelike and they're just standing there. And but where am I going with this? Oh, right. The contrast between these three war memorials, I feel like, is a bit reflective of how these wars also like turned out at the end.
Or at least the myth that like this was the one good war that was less morally ambiguous. Mm-hmm. Like, even though there were a lot of horrific losses and casualties there. And, you know, it was the only time a country used weapons of mass destruction, you know, on another country.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe because the economy of the U.S. profited so much from World War II as compared to other ones, it's allowed us to sort of have this rose-colored glasses.
About, yeah, World War II. Yeah, definitely.
And I'm sure, honestly, even with the reflective and somber mood of the Vietnam and Korean War memorials, I'm sure they are not still really realistic about the U.S.'s role in those wars, right?
Yeah, this is definitely my point of view of the war memorials and like reading the plaques and things. Yes, it definitely sounds it makes more positive spins on the outcomes of these conflicts.
Mm. Yeah, there's a really good poem by this Hmong American poet. I believe Mae Dervang, that talks about the Vietnam War Memorial. And she's like, why isn't my uncle, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, she lists the names of all these Hmong dead who are part of the CIA-supported secret war that against Vietnam, where they were used as guerrillas and then basically kind of left to die there, you know, to the Vietnamese. And many of them did not make it. And they were not honored in the memorial. So it's like a sort of reclaiming of that narrative and those silences and kind of writing yourself into the story.
Yeah.
Which I appreciated.
Mm, yeah. But I also want to give a shout out to Maya Lin, who was the artist behind the Vietnam War Memorial.
It's a powerful piece.
I don't think my family visited the memorial the first time we went to D.C., I was also kind of glad to visit DC as an adult because I definitely feel like I could have a better appreciation of the city as an adult than when I was a child. And I actually really want to go back to DC because there were so many things that I didn't have time to see, because there are like 7 different Smithsonian museums. Yeah. I only had time to visit 3 of them.
Which ones did you go to?
I went to the Museum of American History. And that was kind of disappointing because I specifically wanted to go to it to see Fred Rogers' sweater that they have on display there.
Mr. Rogers?
Yes, they have Mr. Rogers' sweater.
Oh. Wow.
And I did not see it because I asked a docent, where's Mr. Rogers' sweater? And they said that the museum was undergoing renovations and they have so many things in their collection that it's impossible to have everything out, but the sweater's just off display because of renovations and space.
No.
It's like, no. Mm. So I have another reason to go back to DC. But I did see Julia Child's kitchen, and I did see the puppet that was used for Swedish Chef. Yay! Mm. I also went to the National Portrait Gallery, and I saw Michelle Obama and Barack Obama's beautiful portraits. I'm kind of sad that I didn't. They had this, speaking of masculine clothing, but they were selling a tie in the gift shop that was of the same pattern as the background of Obama's portrait. And I'm kind of sad I didn't buy it. But also, I'm kind of wondering, like, what would I do? Well, okay, yes, I'd wear it, but, like, how often would I realistically actually wear it? And then I also went to the museum. The National Portrait Gallery shares the same building as, like, the Gallery of American Art or something. I think that's what it's called. And those are the three that I visited. I did want to go to the Air and Space Museum because this year is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. Woo! but also, I saw so many displays about the suffragette movement and votes for women because this year is also the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote.
Oh.
Does anybody know when Asian American women got the right to vote? Because I know we were
in the 50s, I think.
The earlier sort of anniversary. It was only white women.
Yeah. But... Yes. That's true. It was only white women. I mean,
the 50s was truly not that long ago.
Yeah. But went to the National Archives, saw the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
You didn't try to steal it?
I unfortunately did not try to steal it and see if there was a treasure map on the back.
National treasure.
Yeah, sorry. I also, in my run-up to my trip, I was joking about setting the Declaration of Independence on fire because since it was like end of June, really close to July 4th, and as I've said on the show before, Independence Day is my most hated American holiday, and like I want to sneak a lighter in and just light the Declaration of Independence on fire.
Wow. Tappy, yes, I never knew.
Yes.
Yeah. But there's too much security. I unfortunately could not.
July 4th is... a terrible holiday.
Yeah. I celebrated a friend's birthday that day, whose birthday is on July 3rd. And when she was inviting people, it's like, I would much rather celebrate your birthday than Independence Day.
Yeah. I'm wishing we would have played this poem. We spent the 4th of July in bed. It's by this Palestinian anti-imperialist poet. What's her name? Anyway, she was on Deaf Comedy or Deaf Poetry Jam.
Could we put a recording in here?
Yeah, maybe we could put it. It's like
the magic of editing.
Yeah, as I can edit
can
it in.
Can you look up her name?
Yes. Abby?
It's called We Spent the 4th of July in Bed.
Okay. So here, Hamad.
Yes. She's amazing. She's from Brooklyn and writes a lot of really kind of poignant pieces about, having two brothers that are serving the armed forces as Muslims and how complicated that is and being Palestinian and, being a New Yorker at 9/11 and stuff and really beautiful work. And I wish more people knew about her. But she, like, really is all about solidarity with, kind of all oppressed peoples. And she, name checks, Filipino workers, Japanese victims of the atomic bomb, like all these sort of different things that aren't her struggle, but really kind of tries to, give space for that.
So for this poem, trigger warning for some violent and distressing content.
From Brooklyn and appearing on Broadway in Deaf Poetry Jam, Suhair.
We spent the 4th of July in bed. Even now, walking girls are exploding legs, stepping on shells of American hatred left dug in Iraqi soil. Even now, Malaysian girls choose between the sex trade and hunger. Filipinas go blind constructing the computer disks. Poems like this are saved on even now. Lover, as we lay in amazement, and if, baby, as you say, my skin is the color of sun-warmed sand, then you're my moonless night, and we, the beach, wet, tidal, all that good, wet, yet as we lay, shrapnel awakens pain, courtesy of the 80s gun craze, to our generation, violence isn't a phase, it's the day to day, and though my head is filled with your sweetness,